877-466-3 and learn how your gift of property can make a meaningful difference.
Yo, this is your brother Speech from the crew Arrested Development. You rocking with KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles.
This is the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7, where we bring you the latest news and public issues affecting the areas our students come from, including South and East Los Angeles. I'm Joanne Lifert. Happy New Year's, everyone. On today's show, we turn our attention to an LA public press article investigation into the conditions at several Los Angeles area homeless tiny home communities. Cal State LA Journalism Associate Professor Julie Patel List broke this story. She joins me now to give us some insight into the story. Julie, thank you for joining us today. First of all, tell us a little bit about the investigation.
Yeah, sure. So if I can backtrack a little bit, this is the second investigation in a series of two that I produced, and the first one I produced with my students last year. So if I can just briefly backtrack and talk about that. Yeah, so we have an investigative journalism class at Cal State LA. And in that class, before the semester gets started, I do some public records requests, I do a little bit of initial reporting, and then the students and I get together and we decide what our investigation is going to be that semester. So this time we decided to investigate the tiny homes, which are basically a program in LA County that helps the unhoused folks that they find, you know, gives them shelter for a brief period. I think they're supposed to be there for about 90 days, and then helps place them in permanent housing. So, you know, offers them different services until they're sort of ready to transition into permanent housing. So we decided to look into these and to see how well they're working. Now, of course, as you probably know, Joanne, when you embark on an investigation like this, you know, sometimes you do some initial reporting and you don't find much. Like, you find that things are pretty much working the way they should. And then maybe there is a story there to be done, but it's not going to be a big investigation, right? Because you're not going to need a lot of proof and a lot of evidence and a lot of reporting and a lot of data. Well, what we found out when we went to these different tiny home villages, 12 tiny home villages scattered all around the city. So we went to Wilmington, we went to Eagle Rock, we went to North Hollywood, we went to Reseda, and these villages are basically, just to kind of give you some context of what they look like, each of the villages has about 40 to 100 units, okay? They're built by government agencies. I don't know, have you heard of LASA, the Los Angeles Homeless Services Agency? Okay, so it's basically a joint services authority between the city of LA and the county of LA. So they're the ones who commission having these built, they pay for them, and then every year they hire nonprofits to run them. You know, the nonprofits are ones that you may have heard of, like Hope the Mission, Volunteers of America, Salvation Army, and they're supposed to be transitional housing, as I said before, right? I try to go with different groups of students, different times, so I can do some modeling and interviewing with them watching, and then they could do some interviewing, and we rotate, and then we split up, and we interview different people. So the way we did it is we went several times to each of these tiny homes. So our interview with more than 40 residents and an analysis of government data revealed issues like water leaks, broken heaters, safety hazards. Less than a quarter of the residents were placed into permanent housing when they left the villages, okay? And more than half of the residents ended up homeless once more. On top of that, 4.4%, so of the remaining, you know, 20% or so, another 4.4% of the residents, or 87 people, ended up in jail, prison, or juvenile detention. 33 people died in the villages during this time period that we looked at. There were two villages that were run by Hope the Mission, which is one of the nonprofits, and one that's run by Urban Alchemy, that reported that the residents ended up homeless at rates at or near 70%. And, you know, the average length of stay, like I said, the ideal initial length of stay that they had advertised when they were promoting this tiny home village and why our taxpayer dollars should go into this is 90 days, right? About 90 days, we should be able to find these people permanent homes, most of them. Well, it turns out that the average length of stay in these 12 villages was actually 153 days. So longer than that, obviously. And then, you know, some of these villages like Eagle Rock and Echo Park were even higher at 235 days, 208 days. And many of the residents we talked to had been there for years. You know, and there were a lot of other findings. About half of the 40 plus current and former residents we talked to said that staff members don't respond to their complaints or their requests for help, or they responded too late. 19 said that there are often drugs, alcohol, weapons inside the facilities, despite bans on all three. 19 reported water leaks. 17 complained about access to restrooms, like restrooms were not available or locked up. Interviewees' complaints echoed some of the 29 complaints that we got when we did a public records request from LASA. So that was our investigation that we did last year that finally published earlier this year. After that investigation ran, we heard from an employee at the time at one of the tiny home villages who had worked at a previous tiny home village as well and was able to confirm a lot of what we found and also had additional allegations. And she provided photos and records and other evidence that led us to realize that we needed to do this follow-up story. I did a public records request and we got these so-called incident reports. So the first time we did a public records request with my class, we had gotten complaints, right? This time we got reports that were filed by employees at the villages. So the nonprofit operators have these employees at the villages, and anytime something happens that's major, they're supposed to write it down and do an incident report that then goes to LASA, you know, this government agency, right? We thought we were done with the follow-up investigation, which was going to be more focused on this former employee's issue she raised, and you know, also interviewed 8 residents, current and former residents, at the villages she worked at to corroborate what she told us. And we thought that we were done with the story, but then we started getting these public records back, batches and batches of them at different periods. And they were very difficult to analyze because they were in PDFs, you know, not a spreadsheet. So I started putting each complaint into a spreadsheet and eventually was able to kind of analyze all of them. You know, there were more than 1,400 pages of incident reports that were filed between, January 2022 and early August 2023. And LASA is still providing more, because they haven't given me the recent years. They're releasing them in batches because they have to go and individually redact each incident report to take out the name of the resident for privacy.
Investigation, did you all find out what was part of the issue in terms of getting permanent housing for these residents versus them just staying there?
Your question segues nicely into what the analysis of the 1,400 pages of new data that I got, right? The incident reports. And one of the things that new data found is that a lot of residents were actually being kicked out. It was very inconsistent. In some villages, they would be kicked out automatically if a beanie was found covering up their smoke alarm, for instance, okay? Because that could pose a safety threat to the village, right? And so immediately they would just be kicked out. You know, other villages would give the residents warnings. In some cases, you know, residents would get into fights and the resident who, you know, seemed to have instigated it would be kicked out. And in other cases, nobody would be kicked out. You see what I'm saying? They'd just be given warnings. So it's very inconsistent how they apply it. Yeah, in other cases, you know, if there's an obvious violation, like, you know, they get it on camera where somebody has, you know, one of the residents has walked into another resident's unit, tiny home, and stolen something, then obviously they would be kicked out. So there were actually far more of these incidents of people being kicked out than I would have thought. It was 120. So 120 incidents, residents were kicked out of the villages. Like I said, I had 1,400 pages of incident reports. Each incident report is about 2 pages. I filtered out the reports that dealt with pre-existing or routine medical issues, because that's not what we were really trying to look at. So we were left with 550 incident reports. And of those, like I said, in 120 cases, residents were kicked out. We also found that there were about 150 drug or alcohol-related incidents reported to Lhasa, which alcohol and drugs are not allowed in the villages. And in many of these incident reports, you could see that substance abuse was either causing or exacerbating some of the problems, the fights, that kind of thing. The incident reports also showed that about 110 of them described threats to somebody's, you know, physical safety, where somebody's threatening to kill someone or hurt someone. About 100 noted physical and verbal assaults, and more than 24 involved weapons. And of course, weapons are not allowed in the villages for safety reasons, right? And I mean, the most horrific incident reports dealt with, you know, harm or violence or even like theft alleged to have been done by employees of the villages, because these are people who are supposed to be there to help you, right? And then also there were sexual assaults and rapes and that kind of thing, which were very, very difficult to read about. Yeah, and just horrific that this was happening. Yeah.
Now, when the residents were kicked out, is that when they became homeless again, or did they go to other facilities?
That's a good question. So our data does not say what happens to them in at least half of the incident reports. In the incident reports, they describe, you know, something like, we will give them information about a homeless shelter or something like that. So I do think that, you know, I would suspect that many of these people who were kicked out ended up homeless. And in other cases, they would just leave the village because they were either, you know, in some cases, so tired of a confrontation they were having with another resident or with an employee. So, you know, if you're just leaving, you know, you're probably ending up homeless, right?
In these tiny home communities, did they provide any mental health services for the residents?
It actually varies village by village, because remember, these are different nonprofits that are handling it. The village is supposed to, when you look at like what they're required to do, they're supposed to refer residents who seem to need it to the Department of Health, of Public Health. I don't know how many times that actually happens. The incident reports had quite a few mental health issues and suicide, you know, suicide attempts, that kind of thing. And I know some of the nonprofits, at least in the past, have brought in mental health services to the village. So the Department of, you know, they'll ask the Department of Public Health to provide, like, mobile services. But there, it isn't consistent in terms of how often they do that and how the referrals are made or anything like that.
Yeah. So how did you all initially, you and your students, decide on this particular topic?
Now, remember, this was when we first got started on this. This was in spring 2024. This is what we usually do, is we kind of brainstorm and we end up having 9 or 10 different ideas. And we spend a couple of weeks, you know, kind of narrowing it down. No, we don't spend a couple of weeks. We just spend one class, really, narrowing it down to about 2 to 3 ideas. We break up into groups. We do some research on the idea. We're looking for, you know, has this been investigated previously? If so, is there a different angle that hasn't been looked at that should be looked at? Is there any clues as to whether this needs to be looked at? Because, you know, the riskiest thing in a class like this is we do all this work and we go out for weeks on end, you know, reporting, and we find that there is nothing really to investigate. The things are working well, and, you know, that could be a quick story for one of us, but we certainly don't need a whole class to do a story about that, you know? You know, it's much harder to do investigative reporting because you're having to do so many interviews, you're having to go through so many records and do so much data analysis. So you really do need time. Time is of the essence, and we only have one semester. So I think we got it narrowed down to a few different subjects. There's enough to say, okay, we're going to pursue this project or this project. And we usually only pick one, but in this case, the class was so big that we had to pick two different issues. Yeah, so we did one related to education and one related to tiny homes. The first time we went out and we did our reporting, I think we started seeing issues that surprised us and that we were a little bit kind of, you know, some of us were horrified by. And so we thought, you know what, there's definitely a story here. You know, we don't know how big it's going to be. We don't know how wide scale it's going to be. But at this point, definitely some interviews are confirming what we thought might be going on. And so we just kept at it. And the data and the interviews bore out what we found.
Yeah, so the topics are generated by your journalism students at Cal State LA.
Yeah, we brainstormed together. You're familiar with the University Times at Cal State LA and other newspapers. I don't know if you had one, a student newspaper at your college, but the student newspaper is independently run. So, you know, it isn't a professor kind of, you know, assigning stories or leading the discussion or anything like that. When you're doing an investigation, you really do need somebody in the room, somebody who's part of the team, who has done investigative reporting, who's familiar with the legal matters, because the stakes are so high with investigative reporting. If you get even one thing wrong, not only does it make the whole investigation moot and can kind of ruin the reputation of your entire team or even program or school, but there are real life consequences, right? People can be harmed. I mean, there might be legal consequences, you know, you might be facing a lawsuit and financial damages, right? And so the stakes are very high, so you have to be very careful with investigations. And so really, we work collaboratively as a team. So we brainstorm together, and yeah, the story ideas, I think some of the best story ideas and issues come from the students. Because, as you know, most of our students, at least at Cal State LA, are coming from neighborhoods that are undercovered. And they have public issues that are affecting them that nobody has really taken the time to look into. And so, you know, they know what's going on in these neighborhoods and they know what issues matter most. And I think that's why, you know, of the four investigations published with the students, two of them were related to housing, you know, because housing is such a big issue for our students, as you know, and for their neighborhoods and their families and communities.
What did you find was the most surprising aspect of your investigation?
I would say, you know, of the most recent investigations, so the follow-up that I did this semester while I'm on sabbatical, I would say the most surprising thing is that there was documentation of these incidents happening, right? So for the first investigation, we were doing interviews mainly to record some of these things. But the second investigation, you know, I got these public records back that showed that employees were filing these incident reports. And so the folks over at LASA and also the former employee that I talked to, she had been emailing public officials, other folks, city council members, county supervisors, just different people to let them know that, hey, like, I'm an employee and these are the kinds of things that are happening. So between her and these incident reports, you know, our government employees and officials knew that this was happening. And so I think what was surprising is that more hasn't been done to address these issues, that these issues are still happening. Because again, so far, the incident reports we got are only really from 2022 and 2023, right? I'm still waiting on the ones from 2024 and 2025. So if they knew about it, you know, at least a few years ago, like, you know, I'm just surprised that, you know, in my recent interviews and the more recent interviewing that I did with students, that we found that these issues are kind of ongoing.
Yeah, I know I had read the article and saw some of the pictures of some of the conditions that were kind of deplorable and shocking to see, you know, the how things looked and how they had gotten to that point. Because I remember seeing on the news when they first, you know, first introduced the concept of these tiny home communities. Mm-hmm. It seemed like a good thing initially, you know, to have a place to keep your things and a safe place to stay at night. But, you know, sometimes things are unpredictable and you just never know how they will turn out. So I know this investigation is definitely eye-opening into like the daily lives of what's going on in the tiny home villages and some of the challenges that the residents and the staff are facing because of the conditions. So if someone would like to read this article, where can they find it?
The article is on LA Public Press, which is I would say newish, 5 to 8 years maybe. It's a publication online, and it's called lapublicpress.org, and it's one of those digital-only newsrooms. So you go to lapublicpress.org. If I were you, I would go under investigations, the investigations tab, or I actually have a link that goes directly to the story. It's bit.ly/LA Tiny Homes. So bit.ly/LA Tiny Homes. And that'll take you directly to the story. It's called Employees Documented Abuse and Filth at LA Tiny Home Villages. Officials did next to nothing.
So having done this investigation, it's opened up, you know, I guess this issue to others in the community. Is there any resolve that's coming from this at all?
In terms of what public officials, you know, how they responded, we had contacted some folks on the LASA board and some other public officials, those who the former employee that I interviewed had reached out to. And I didn't hear back from most, but I did hear back from County Supervisor Horvath. She said in response to our first project and the email that she got earlier this year from the former employee, she said that the situation at the tiny homes reinforces to her the need for major changes to homeless program spending and the need for more accountability. She said, quote, "This LASA contracted program, like too many across the system, is falling short. And the people we serve are the ones who are paying the price." When we reached out to Councilmember Isabel Jurado, she said in April that she and her staff are working with various stakeholders to make adjustments to the tiny home villages in an attempt to improve outcomes. She said, quote, "While we recognize the challenges highlighted in recent reports, we understand that providing services is a complex task and issues arise. We take every constituent complaint seriously, working with oversight bodies to investigate concerns promptly." And then I should add that both LASA and Hope the Mission, the nonprofit that ran the two villages that we were looking at, they also had comments. There is a new nonprofit that's taken over one of those villages, but for the time period we examined, it was Hope the Mission that ran it. Hope the Mission basically told us that, you know, they did have a high volume of incident reports, but that often reflects that their employees are actually doing what they're supposed to. You know, they're documenting what they're supposed to by filing these incident reports in the first place. They said that it has been working on tackling the issues that it sees in the incident reports. It's made many changes to improve operations, including better reporting tools, more trauma-informed and crisis response training, increased access to on-site mental health support and counseling. They also noted, among other things, that being in a tiny home village is an improvement over being on the streets for most people. Of course, that there are, you know, difficult adjustments that need to be made when you're dealing with a population that's coming, an unhoused population that has been on the streets. And also that kicking out residents for them is a last resort. In terms of LASA, LASA Communications Director Ahmed Chapman said the agency is, quote, "aware of several issues with the Alexandria and Arroyo Seco tiny home villages," and, quote, "takes allegations like these very seriously." He also said that LASA is working to improve conditions in all the tiny homes. It's updated monitoring procedures, adopted new performance indicators to ensure the nonprofits running the villages follow protocols and are more prepared to take corrective action more quickly. Chapman also said the agency will, quote, "continue to work with all necessary parties to ensure provider staff receive appropriate training and offer victims resources and connections to law enforcement to ensure every participant has dignity and respect as they complete their journey to a more permanent home." I don't know if you know, but LASA has been in the news because they're an independent audit commissioned by Judge David Carter found that Lhasa was not doing a great job of tracking what was happening in a lot of the programs that they're running, because Lhasa doesn't just do the tiny homes. They also run shelters, right? And they help with other housing and homelessness issues. They do the homeless count, if you've ever heard of the homeless count, you know, where they count up how many homeless people there are. That's all Lhasa. So, Judge Carter had ordered this independent audit that found issues with how Lhasa was operating. So Lhasa's working on that. Yeah, I mean, I do think that the public officials want to do something about it. But there are others who didn't even get back to us. So it's just surprising. I'm sure they have a lot going on. But I would hope that, you know, they care when they read this story, they see kind of what's happening. And, you know, it's hard not to be kind of horrified by, you know, as journalists, we really try to be balanced and objective. When you're reading these incident reports and it's only human, you're tearing up, you know, it's just, you're a human being. Like, it's hard not to.
It is disturbing. When I was reading the article, I'm like, oh my goodness, I didn't know that is the direction that this, you know, experiment to get people off the street has pivoted into something that was not intended. At least that was not the perception given when they were talking about it initially. Well, Julie, I'd like to thank you so much for joining me and telling us a little bit about your investigation that is plaguing several LA homeless tiny communities. So thank you so much. And maybe there'll be a part 3 down the road with your next class. But I wanted to thank you again for joining us and telling us a little bit about what's happening in the community.
Thank you so much, Joanne, for helping bring this issue to light as well through KPFK.
If you'd like to read more about this story, you can go to bit.ly/LA Tiny Homes. That's bit.ly/LA Tiny Homes. The first investigation can be found at bit.ly/Tiny Homes Investigation.
We'll be right back. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
Some of my Cal State LA students from my University Times class took a look at some of the area events. Demarion Davis, Destiny Durant, and Josemary Molina will start things off.
Culture, identity, and leadership. Black Student Union provides a place on university campuses for just that. It is a space created for Black students to feel seen, supported, and celebrated. During this holiday season, coming together as one and celebrating with one another is what community is all about.
Dear Lord Jesus, thank you so much just for bringing all these beautiful Black people together. I want to thank you for community. I want to thank you for all these wonderful schools. schools and all the leadership that are here to represent, Lord. I just want to pray over our conversations. Please just help us be beneficial. Help us to learn, discuss problems, discuss leadership strategies. And I want to thank you again for all our brothers and sisters, Lord. I want to pray over our food. Please make it a nourishment to our stomachs, Lord. And just help us to walk out of here making a friend, building a connection that can last beyond graduation so that we can all just be connected as a Black community across our different campuses. And in your name I pray. Amen.
Five universities across Southern California came together to celebrate Thanksgiving. Through food, culture, music, and friends, the community was able to join as one. One of the coordinators of the event and Cal State LA's BSU president, Brenda Drew, talked about the collaboration.
It was a really amazing event. We had about 100, maybe 115 people show up, all from the different campuses. And it was a really impactful event because it really helped Black students feel held and supported and loved. This is because Black students hardly ever get the platform to connect on such a massive level with other Black students in a way that isn't performative, in a way that isn't lecture-based or strictly education-based, but more so about community and about community empowerment, breaking bread with your fellow students.
Finding ways to connect in the Black community is so important. Having Black culture be a part of Thanksgiving called for a greater name, which is why this Thanksgiving celebration had a different name to it. Here's from Hermani Douglas, Cal State Northridge BSU president, on why they chose to call this celebration Afro-Giving.
We chose Afro-Giving. We first started off with Friendsgiving, and we were like, okay, like, because we're all friends, we're coming together. But they were like, we need something Black. We need something that's part of our culture. And, you know, we rock our Afros with pride, elegance, and nobody can tell us anything about our Afro. So we said Afro-Giving. That's something that's dear to us. That's something that's history made. I feel like that's a stamp saying that we're here. So we just said Afro-Giving is perfect. So, yeah.
Afro-Giving builds on community and unity. Through this event, the Black community shared not only a meal, but celebrating connection, resilience, culture, and history.
What community means to us is really like togetherness, having a space where you feel like you can be yourself, like your full authentic self, where you can drop your shoulders.
Afro-Giving, many were able to pause, recognize, and reflect on how far they have all come. For years, the Black community has been subject to racism, discrimination, and prejudice. On nights like these, joining arms is a time to appreciate the support, pride, and strength that the BSU family across all university campuses provide every day.
Collaboration, I feel like when it comes to really strengthening numbers, it's really coming together, kind of like what we're saying today.
The concept of five different schools coming together to celebrate culture and community is exactly what the Black Student Union embodies and stands for. Beyond just the food and music, the BSU acknowledges and remembers those that came before them and fought hard for them. This is what UCLA's BSU Vice President Sierra Anguiano had to say.
Afrogiving really fits in the sense of our purpose this year is really to build more community and unity with one another. I think a lot of times from what we've heard with at least our Black population here at UCLA is that they don't feel united, or rather that some of us don't even know that they have a Black Student Union. So for us, it's to find ways to connect our Black community and tell them we're here. We're here for you, and we're here to celebrate you. So Afrogiving is a way for us to not only to connect and to create a community, but to really get to know one another on a deeper personal level, so we can really create a student union that they can feel proud of and feel represented in.
As the holiday season approaches, we give thanks, we celebrate the sense of belonging and the community built through it. The BSU is a community that sees you, values you, and celebrates you for all you are. Through this Afrogiving event, they celebrated a connection that makes the BSU family so special. In Los Angeles, I'm your host, Destiny Durant, with Demarion Davis and Jose Mary Molina.
The city of Compton has opened a new museum. Leslie Hudson has more.
Hi, I'm Leslie Hudson with the University Times at Cal State LA. I'm here reporting the celebration of art, community, and culture in Compton.
This event brings together local residents, volunteers, and artists whose work highlights the power of community storytelling. One of these artists is Carlos Gande, whose pieces are currently featured in the Boundless Echoes exhibit at the Compton Museum.
For the Boundless Echoes exhibit, I have a few art prints that are exhibiting right now, digital artwork. They're very political. My work is political cartoons.
Carlos's work spans digital illustration, live painting, and political art. Before the event began, he walked us through several of the pieces he brought for the evening.
This one's not finished yet, obviously. It's in progress, but it's going to be called A Museum in Every Hood. This one's especially for Compton Museum. This one is called La Agresión del Tiempo, or The Aggression of Time. This one is called El Pan Que No Se Comió, or The Bread That Was Not Eaten, as you can see. And this one down here is a personal piece that I brought because Mark told me he likes it. It's called Shame. It's an older piece, but I feel like these three kind of fit like a darker themes all go together and curate.
On top of giving a thorough explanation of his work, Carlos also expressed his time here at the ball.
I love painting, so I'm honestly just having a good time here, having a blast, being in a really beautiful and inspiring space.
Artists like Carlos brings powerful visual storytelling to the event. Community volunteers keep the space running smoothly. One of those volunteers is Destiny Cacique. Destiny has remained dedicated and will discuss her role for fostering community connections and the importance of local engagement.
I'm a resident of Compton, and I love to build community, to know my neighbors, to do something that's for a good cause. I'm in charge of helping with the photo booth. I'm also in charge of keeping the bathrooms clean, and then I'm also going to be serving the food. So that is why I'm today.
After discussing her responsibilities, Destiny shared what she enjoys most about attending the Compton Museum Ball.
Meeting all the people and meeting the other volunteers who probably also reside in Compton, most of them do. And then just networking, like I just met this awesome artist and seeing familiar faces.
Volunteering isn't just about staffing an event. It's about strengthening the relationships that make Compton feel like home. The Compton Museum Ball highlights the intersection of art, community service, and cultural pride. Whether through political artwork or dedicated volunteer work, residents continue to shape the narrative of their city.
This is Leslie Hudson for the University Times at Cal State LA.
The Luckman Theater on the Cal State LA campus is hosting an art exhibit. Omar Ortiz and Emmanuel Martinez have more.
So this exhibit is comprised of a lot of multimedia and different...
Holidays wouldn't be the same without family. No matter your roots or the holiday you celebrate, family is at the heart of many of our treasured traditions during this time of year. At Cal State LA, the Luckman Gallery celebrates this dynamic with a tender excavation. An exhibition bringing together over a dozen artists from across cultural groups to showcase what family means to them. Cal State LA University Times community news reporter Omar Ortiz visited the Luckman Gallery to learn more about this exhibition.
The overall goal of this exhibition here is to bring artists and people from the Los Angeles and Southern California area who have different backgrounds and culture, and to tell a story about the American struggle, archiving familial photos, and how we tell these past stories in the present that can be shown again in the future.
Justin Cohn is the Marketing and Content Coordinator at Cal State LA's Luckman Fine Arts Complex. The complex states that this exhibition approaches research-based artistic practices through propositions of alternative histories, bringing together a group of artists that work with historical and familial photographic archives as a point of departure to construct new narratives and elicit transformation.
So in the exhibition, we have artists, LA-born, who are either Native Tongva tribe, Mexican-American, Asian-American, Eastern European-American, and how they have collected the memories of their families and tried to tell a story that is both consistent and familiar to one another.
Familial memories take shape in many different forms. Take Jamil G. Baldwin's A Continuum of Something That No Longer Exists. This piece is an enlarged piece of film strip. At first glance, the faded colors and wavy paper don't reveal much to the viewer, as Cohn explains.
And by looking at it, you wouldn't understand what it is. But in the context of what the artist was trying to convey, it was a lost strip of film that his father had left to him before he passed away. He was 10 years old. He went and got this film developed. It didn't get developed correctly. It was just a roll of colors. And even though he was unable to see his late father's work, he was able to blow it up and express it in a way that felt powerful and important to him. So,
expressions could be found all over the gallery. Meli Barragan's Family Legacy showcases her late grandfather's Bracero program ID card on a faded black and white flag. A white jar with a third row open displays Memory Exercise by Camille Wong, where recordings of their family members' drawings helps them rediscover past memories. And Hsu Kwan's A Ritual for Metamorphosis combines dancing 3D nudists with home video footage. Cohn says these unique pieces all add up to one shared goal.
I think what each artist wants to tell with this story is that my family makes up who I am. It makes up my genetic makeup. It makes up my history in order to tell my current story and the story that I want to share about who I am.
The exhibition also drew stirring reactions from visitors like Dr. Akila Anand from CSULA School of Criminal Justice and Criminalistics.
We have much more in common than we have, you know, like we have much more in common than we think, because we're all trying to process these ancestral traumas. We're all trying to live forth in a way that honors our heritage.
Students also saw the values of family on display. Third year English major Clara Garza mentioned how the artist's creativity stood out during her visit.
You can make art out of anything, and that it is really important to value your family, and you can make some very beautiful art just by collecting remnants of the past and creating something new out of it.
The exhibition will continue until February 21, 2026. Cohn hopes visitors will take inspiration to create memories as they leave the exhibit.
Goals change, we change, but our memories last, and we want to hold on to those memories and uplift them. And I hope that the viewers that come into the gallery can really take a piece of that, you know.
From Los Angeles at Cal State LA Community News, This was Emmanuel Martinez and Amar Ortiz reporting.
I mean, y'all probably didn't have the choice because your teacher and your professor said we're doing it. But
to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. Our theme music is Contagious by Mark Vard. I'm Joanne Lightford. From all of us at Cal State LA, thank you for tuning in and Happy New Year.
To love public radio, but it's a special thing to support it. Consider this. If you've got a car you don't need anymore, or you've got one that is simply too expensive to repair, arrange to donate it to KPFK. It's easy for you, pickup is free, and it could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thanks in advance, and here is how to get started. Go to kpfk.org/cars or call 877-573-5288. That is 1-877-KPFK-AUTO. And learn more.
What's going on, family? From the Bay to L.A., my name is Kat Brooks. My show, Law & Disorder, is now on KPFK. Cutting-edge interviews with organizers, culture workers, newsmakers, and freedom fighters. The weekly state terror roundup, resistance in residence with artists using their gifts to change the world, and letters from the inside. That's just a small taste of what this show is about as we seek to expose, agitate, and